I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today's Encore Like It Is program features Paula Giddings, a writer, historian, and civil rights activist, and Art Schell, former head football coach of the Los Angeles Raiders, and a college and pro football Hall of Fame inductee. Paula Giddings is the author of a landmark study on the political and social history of black women, a journalist who has written extensively on both international and national issues. In 1976, while in Europe, Ms. Giddings was part of the press corps which accompanied President Jimmy Carter on his first trip abroad. She was assigned a pool reporter for his meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia and the President of France. Ms. Giddings is a 1969 Howard University graduate. Thank you for joining me, Ms. Giddings. Now tell me, how did you get started writing?
Bob, I can't remember not wanting to write. I've always wanted to write and start at a very young age. But I'll tell you a turning point in a lot of my thinking. And I was very young. I used to write poetry. And since then, I think I did the world a favor by abandoning poetry. But one of the things that changed that and that was very important to my perspective and I think the rest of my career was something called the Freedom Rides in 1961. I was very young. I was 13 years old. But that had such an impact on me, and the heroism of that ride, the fact that young people took part in it, if you remember, and even left school to become part of the civil rights movement then. And I was 13 years old then and living in a predominantly white neighborhood in Yonkers, New York, where I grew up. And remember, in those days, people didn't really, until the civil rights movement, people didn't talk about race a lot on certain levels. And I'll never forget, after being so moved and after so many things happened there as a result of those rides, of going to school the next day and no one talked about it. I mean, the teachers didn't talk about it, the students didn't talk about it. And I remember asking then a lot of questions. I mean, starting even then, the questions of what made people do these things? What made this heroic effort? What was the history of that? What was the background of that? And you remember in one part of the rides, there was a great deal of violence, where whites sort of met one of the buses with tire irons and firebombs. I also asked myself, where did the hatred come from? Where did that part come from? So I think I just started some inquiries about race and attitudes in the country and started thinking about writing along journalistic lines more after that.
Society is still facing similar problems of the 60s with racism and sexism, to name a few. Why?
Well, we haven't really resolved the question of race. And we haven't resolved the question of sex and sexism either. And until we do that, we're going to see a lot of things begin to happen. There have been some important changes, but they've created something else which is kind of new that we haven't been able to deal with. What has changed, of course, since the mid-60s is that now at least we have legislation that's against discrimination and against job discrimination and all that. It has resulted in blacks and whites and other groups who are not even biracial anymore. I mean, we're talking about also Asian Americans and Native Americans and Latinas and et cetera. Now we all find ourselves within the same institutions more than ever before in terms of educational institutions. We're working together more. We are more apt to live together, even though that's not happening on the same level with the rest of it. But we're doing that now on a basis of what I call co-equality. I mean, we were all expecting the same thing and the same rights and the same salaries. And that's creating another kind of conflict. And so we're seeing race emerge, but racism emerge still, but sort of under different circumstances, under circumstances of a great deal of competition, under circumstances where it is much more difficult to fight for group rights in these sort of integrated settings. It gets a little bit more complex. And what happens, Bob, I think, is that sometimes we think about using the same strategies now that we did in the past when we were excluded from those institutions where no one could get in. And there's certain strategies that you use to get in. But once you're in, there's a new set of realities that happen, a new set of dynamics, and we're not quite comfortable with all of that yet. So we're seeing a lot of things. This time, especially on the college campus, reminds me of the World War I years. when increasing numbers of black students were coming onto the campus. And we saw a good amount of the same kind of hostility that we see now. And people now will say it's a lot of this is about affirmative action and that kind of thing. But, you know, racism didn't just start with affirmative action. So obviously there's something else that was going on. And in fact, in the World War I years, it was blacks who were talking about meritocracy, you know, who were saying, just let us in on the basis of our test scores, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of it just comes down to competition.
Are historically black colleges fulfilling their mission?
Yes, one of the important things that black, historically black colleges give us is certainly a sense of community with each other. That's very, very important. And that, you know, we used to take all that for granted, but we can't take it for granted anymore that we can find a sense of community. I went to an historically black college. I'm a graduate of Howard University. And that's one of the thing. That's one of the reasons why I went. There's a certain kind of development that goes on in black colleges, a social development that's much more difficult in predominantly white colleges. And studies have shown that in fact black students and black colleges have a higher intellectual development rate in the black colleges, mainly because there's not certain kinds of racial tensions. They're more involved in extracurricular activities. They have role models of black professors to look at and black presidents and all. And that's very, very important. There are some very similar things that you see in women's colleges versus, you know, co-ed colleges, where women have certain kinds of a higher development in under those circumstances.
Now, you mentioned role models. Why are role models important to African Americans?
And it's very important that we begin to look at the history and begin to see what people could do in certain periods of time. And I say the people who did more with less, even than what we have. Someone like a Phyllis Wheatley, who really begins the African American literary tradition. She's the first black person to publish a book in North America, the second woman to do so. And what was extraordinary about her to me is that this woman emerged and had this poetic and creative fire and an instinct at a time, and this is we're talking about the 1770s, even before the Revolutionary War, in a place in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts colony, where there wasn't a lot of culture around her. I mean, the question is, where did she get this inspiration from? There were no plays, there were no orchestras to listen to, there weren't a lot of books in the house. Most people then in that colony couldn't even read, much less write. So she was even one of the few people who could even read. And to become inspired, you see, to write poetry is quite an extraordinary thing. And so one thing we can learn from her is that we don't have to be surrounded by all of the great books and have a great education. She didn't have that much of an education. She was a self-starter and a self-learner. And to be in sort of this acculturated setting all the time, to be inspired to create and to be an artist. And a lot of our artists have come out of similar circumstances. So she's someone to think about. I certainly thought about someone like Harriet Tubman, who we all know about, the Underground Railroad and the conductor, and going into the South 19 times, each time with a higher price on her head to bring others out. And beyond her heroism and her courage and her cleverness to be able to do it all these times. I mean, Harriet Tubman, I one of the things I respect most is the fact that, if you remember the first time that she saw freedom, the first time that she got away and she crossed into Philadelphia, and she decided that to be free, but to be alone, and not to bring anybody with you, was meaningless in the end. And that's what made her go back. And I think that's an important lesson, you know, that to be free, to be the first to do anything doesn't matter if there's not a second, if you're not bringing somebody along with you. And so, I mean, the things like that I think about. We also have a very, we can get our ethics out of our history. And I say that, you know, we should know these stories, like the Harriet Tubman story, or the Phyllis Wheatley story, as well as we know any text, as well as we know what's in the Bible. I mean, we get, and a lot of these people were inspired, in fact, religiously. And that it's important to see these role models also in history and what they were able to accomplish under the most dire circumstances.
And then there was Fannie Lou Hamer.
She was wonderful. I love when Fannie Lou Hamer was, of course, on a plantation, sharecropper. She was a timekeeper in Mississippi, Sunflower County, Mississippi. And in a situation where, as she said later, she didn't even know that black people had the right to vote in the 60s. And then one day, some SNCC workers, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, student movement, SNCC workers came down and began to talk about voting. And she said, you know, she said, I got this vision. I could see myself voting people out of office who didn't care anything about the poor and putting new people in office. I mean, she became empowered at that moment. And we could see what happened when a person like this gets empowered. I mean, Fannie Lou Hamer stood up and just became, I think, one of our most important leaders of the period. Became also very, of course, involved with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And who will ever forget, those of us who are old enough to have seen her on network television during that period of time. And if you remember, it was no coincidence that her statement was cut short, because when Lyndon Baines Johnson saw what was going on, because if you remember, they were trying to get seated as the delegates and unseat the Mississippi racist white supremacist delegation. And there's no coincidence that that was just absolutely cut off immediately to get the focus away from her, because when she told that story, when the moral authority that she had for the rights of black people to take those seats in the so-called democratic country was just extraordinary. And she's just one of the most certainly one of the most inspiring figures in our history that I think about.
To tell these stories, we need writers. Do we have enough African American writers out there to tell these stories?
Well, there's never enough, and it's a whole other story to get published and to be able to disseminate your work as it should. We need to, and it's very important to encourage people to write. A lot of people don't even think about writing, and a lot of talented people don't even try. And so, I would hope that people who have any sense, any passion for writing, to pursue it. You have to pursue it through some very difficult times. All writers are rejected a lot. I always say that you're not a real writer until you have a stack of rejection slips. You know, this this high. That shows that you're really a writer, and every writer has them. You have to be not afraid of rejection and keep going at it. And it's hard. It's hard to do it. But it's also very fulfilling, and I think it's also a very, very important function. It's very nice to be able to do other forms of expression. But you know, in this society, it's almost not real unless it's written down. We know that that's not true. I mean, that shouldn't be that way, but it is. And so it's very, very important to have those stories in our books and get those books out to our kids. It's very important. And to have a value of books and reading and writing in the home. That's so important. And I must say, you go to another, you even go to a lot of middle class homes, and there are no books in the house, black homes. And that just drives me crazy. We have to have this value of words and how important they are, and especially words about us. And I urge people also to support, I'm going to do a little self-advertisement now, is to support black authors. You know, buy books, even if you're not so crazy about the book, buy the book. Because one day, a book that you will be crazy about will be there because you bought the other books. If you go to a bookstore, it's very hard often to get books, and it's a whole process to get a book in a bookstore. If the book isn't there, ask the proprietor, whomever, the bookstore, to order the book for you through the store, because often they'll order two or three books, and someone else will also have a chance to get a book. So there's lots of kinds of consciousness that I hope we have about supporting black authors, who and certainly organizations should support black books. I mean, it's just as, you know, a bestseller is only about, what's considered a bestseller is only about 25 or 30,000 copies bought within a certain amount of time. We have organizations with hundreds of, with 175,000 people, with 50,000 people. It's so easy to buy one book. And it would be so important in terms of empowering Black writers to get their things published. Because when the publisher knows that there's a constituency for a book, they will publish it.
To the would-be journalist out there, what advice would you give?
A couple of things. First of all, read. Read everything. And pay attention to, especially the kind of writing that you're doing. If you're writing poetry, I mean, read everything, but also read poets, not only other poets, not only for the content, but how they do things. You know, it's a part of the craft of writing is just learning how to express certain things in an effective way. That's very important. Publishing has to be approached like any career. You have to do research in it. There's a reference book called The Literary Marketplace, which lists all editors and literary prizes and publishing companies, etc. And it's very important to begin to understand who to begin to send your work to. The other thing, after reading and after writing, you should write as much as you can, is to get something published. And that has to be sort of looked at very systematically of how to do it. The reference book I mentioned will give you the names of editors. For example, you never send anything to an editor in a book company unsolicited or, you know, without somebody's name on it. It'll just go into a slush pile. So that's also very important. Send it out to magazines. And again, expect to get rejected 90% of the time, but we're going for the 10% that will begin your career. And so I think those things are, you have to be tenacious. You have to sort of get up in the morning and that's what you're thinking about doing. I mean, you should much of your life has to sort of revolve around that effort that you're making. And you just keep at it.
It's Like It Is. I'm Bob Franklin. My next guest is Art Schell. With his elevation as head coach of the LA Raiders, Mr. Schell made history. Mr. Schell is an alumnus of Maryland State College, now the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Thanks for joining me, Mr. Schell. What problems do African Americans face in their quest to secure head coaching positions in the NFL?
Well, I think that the most important thing here is that we as Afro Americans have to show our desire to become coaches in the National Football League. I can remember when I first started playing, there were a lot of guys that didn't want to coach. So they didn't let it be known that they wanted to coach. So now all of a sudden, it's beginning to change. And I think what you have to do, you have to make sure that the powers that may be know that you want to coach. And I let it be known that I wanted to be a coach in the National Football League. And about my seventh or eighth year in the league, and I played another 8 years, and when the time came for me to retire, and then I went to my boss and I said, hey, time's now, and I'd like to be a coach, man, what we talked about. And so I had set the groundwork, I laid it out, and when the time came, I was not a head coach, but a coach in the league.
How did you prepare yourself for the head coaching position with the LA Raiders?
Well, you know, as a player, I always try to learn as much as I could about the game. I was an offensive lineman. I just didn't want to know offensive line play. I wanted to know what the defense was doing. I wanted to know what the coverages were that teams are using against us. I wanted to know every aspect of the game that I possibly could learn as a player without taking away from my play. And as time went along, coaches could see that I was a student of the game. John Madden saw that I was a student of the game. Tom Flores saw it. And they were excited about that. And so I prepared myself in that sense. I tried to learn as much as I could about the game from the offensive side as well as the defensive side. So when the time came for me to become a coach, I was ready for it.
What's been the most revolutionary change to occur in the NFL during your playing and coaching career?
During my time, most thing is the money. And the money is a big thing. And, of course, the players are so much bigger and larger now, and it's so much faster. And the game has such impact in it now it's been a major change. But now, all of a sudden, the little guys again coming back into the game of professional sports. And I think that's a big plus for everybody.
Now, steroids are a problem everywhere. How has the abuse of steroids affected the level of performance by professional football players?
Let me say this. I guess I'm naive about steroids because I didn't know anything about steroids until recently in the last 5 or 6 years. Steroids were a thing that I'd heard about but didn't know exactly what it represented. All of a sudden, I started noticing things, sizes of players, you know. But those things happened as far as the players were concerned. They got bigger, but they also became injury-prone, and that was a big problem. So I can understand why someone would want to take a drug that would enhance their look and maybe their speed and size, but also there was a side effect of having injuries. And I couldn't understand. I still don't understand it. But I think the National Football League is now cracking down on that. They want to get it out of sports. And I think it has to also start in high school. That's where it has to start. A lot of kids, young kids, want to enhance their performance by getting bigger, larger, and faster, and they don't worry about the side effects. Sure, when you're young, 20 years old, you don't worry about it, but somewhere along the line, you're going to pay for it. And we have to teach those guys that you don't have to have those things in order to play the game.
There was the so-called Bounty Bowl between the Eagles and the Cowboys. There were allegations of coaches paying certain players to injure the opponent's key players. Now, do you feel this is an example of excessive violence in professional football?
First of all, I don't agree that that happened. I don't think Buddy Ryan or any coach in this league puts out bounties on people. I think players will do that themselves if they think someone is trying to hurt them, maim them. The game, the nature of the game is violence in the sense that you play the game real hard. But to say someone actually puts out a bounty on somebody, no, I don't think that's it. You might hear a guy, a defensive lineman, say to another defensive lineman, okay, I'll bet you I can get to the quarterback 2 times this game, or I'll get to him more than you will. That's a bet between the two of them, just getting to the quarterback. But I don't think anybody, if they respect the profession, tries to maim another player in the game. I just don't believe that. I mean, we all respect each other. Now, if someone is trying to maim your teammate, there are always bad apples in any cart. If someone is trying to maim your teammate, then maybe somebody say, we're going to get that guy. That guy cannot be allowed to do what he's doing in this game. The game is better than that. So as far as the bounty is concerned, I don't think it's there.
If it was there, what should we do about eliminating it?
Well, you eliminate it by going to the source. If it's happening, you go to the source, and I think the commissioner, and I can't tell him what to do, I think you should get those kinds of people out of the league.
Now, Mr. Sherrill, who should be blamed for athletes graduating from high school and colleges with little or no academic skills?
I think it encompasses a whole spectrum. I think it encompasses the parents. They have to take credit for it. And I also think the instructors. I think the student has to take responsibility also. I mean, everybody has to take responsibility for it. And in college, these coaches got to make sure these kids go to school. The parents aren't there. They got to make sure they graduate.
Now, as you know, Mr. Sherrill, not everyone can play professional football. What would you suggest to the thousands of high school and collegiate football players who fail to make it in the very competitive NFL?
First of all, the NFL should not be your goal. You'd like to get there if you can, but you got to look at it. There are only maybe 1,500 guys that can play professional football. I mean, that's not many people. And all of the football teams across the country in college, I mean, there's only your chances of making the National Football League are like 1 in a million. You have to be in the right place at the right time. You have to have the talent. Everybody does not have the talent to play professional football. And I think if you gear yourself for professional sports, you're entering into a losing mode. You won't win. You need to gear yourself for a career without football. Get your education, and whatever life you decide to go into, whatever career you want to enter, then try to achieve that goal. If you are fortunate enough to play professional sports, then fine, that's icing on the cake. Then you delay your real career. Professional sports, you don't play that long. And I think kids are kidding themselves, parents are kidding themselves, they're gearing their kids to play professional sports. That's the wrong idea. I got 2 kids, and I tell them, get your education. Don't worry about professional sports. If you're good enough, you get a chance, fine. But if you don't have an education, you're lost.
Now, Mr. Sherrill, you are a graduate of Maryland State College on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, now the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. What contributions have small black colleges made to professional football?
Well, it's been a lot. As far as a lot of great athletes that have gone into professional football from the smaller colleges, and some are still going, but not as many as before. And I think the reason because of that, because of integration, and a lot of the big schools have reaped a lot of the talent from that the smaller schools would normally get. And so the small schools can't compete as far as getting the type of athlete because of whatever, the glamour or what have you, being on TV, they can't compete. So we still had a lot of guys from small schools going into the professional ranks, making their contribution, showing that they could play with anybody no matter what school they came from. They were capable of playing with guys from Ohio State or Michigan or Michigan State. Had the talent, all you need is a chance to play.
How do you evaluate a player from a small college?
Well, we try to evaluate them as we do any other school, but we also, with our organization, try to project players 3-4 years down the road. Maybe this kid at a small black school didn't have the coaching, all the necessary things that go into big-time coaching in order to compete. So maybe he's a little behind. But if you are wise enough and see the talent that this kid has, maybe you can project him 3 or 4 years down the road as being a player in the National Football League. So we look very hard at these players in these schools.
What's been the greatest football game you ever played in?
Oh, I played in a lot of great games. It's hard to pinpoint one particular game. But my greatest satisfaction had to have been playing in my first Super Bowl. In Super Bowl XI, we played in Pasadena. We played the Minnesota Vikings. And the reason why it was so great for me because we had finally achieved what we wanted, which was to play in the Super Bowl. And we felt that that was the hardest thing, getting to the Super Bowl. And we felt that once we were there, we were going to win. And we went out and won the football game.
Aside from entertainment, what other value does professional football add to American society?
Well, I think it gives fans around the country something to cheer about, an outlet, go to the stadium, cheer, root for your team, let out some of your emotions. I think it does that. I think it also shows that leadership as far as teamwork, those kinds of things. I think professional football also creates an atmosphere that's conducive for winning and molding young men into being leaders in our nation.
Special thanks to Paula Giddings, author of Ida, A Sword Among Lions, Ida B. Wells and the Campaign Against Lynching, and Art Shell, the second African-American head coach in the history of professional football and the first in sports modern era. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.